10. The Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots. Thomas Jefferson, 1787. That is, I thought I was a trained soldier until I reported to my ship. Any law against having a wrong opinion? I see that I didn't make any mention of how the Terran Federation moved from peace to a state of emergency, and then on into war. I didn't notice it too closely myself. When I enrolled, it was peace, the normal condition. At least so people think. Whoever expects anything else. Then, when I was at Curie, it became a state of emergency. But I still didn't notice it. As what Corporal Bronski thought about my haircut, uniform, combat drill, and kit was much more important. And what Sergeant Zim thought about such matters was overwhelmingly important. In any case, emergency is still peace. Peace is a condition in which no civilian pays any attention to military casualties which do not achieve page 1 lead story prominence, unless that civilian is a close relative of one of the casualties. But if there ever was a time in history when peace meant that there was no fighting going on, I have been unable to find out about it. When I reported to my first outfit, Willie's Wildcats, sometimes known as Company K, 3rd Regiment, 1st MI Division, and shipped with them in the Valley Forge, with that misleading certificate in my kit, the fighting had already been going on for several years. The historians can't seem to settle whether to call this one the 3rd Space War or the 4th, or whether the 1st Interstellar War fits it better. We just call it the Bug War, if we call it anything, which we usually don't. And in any case, the historians date the beginning of war after the time I joined my first outfit and ship. Everything up to then and still later were incidents, patrols, or police actions. However, you are just as dead if you buy a farm in an incident as you are if you buy it in a declared war. But to tell the truth, a soldier doesn't notice a war much more than a civilian does, except his own tiny piece of it, and that just on the days it is happening. The rest of the time, he is much more concerned with sack time, the vagaries of sergeants, and the chances of wheedling the cook between meals. However, when Kitten Smith and Al Jenkins and I joined them at Luna Base, each one of Willie's Wildcats had made more than one combat drop. They were soldiers, and we were not. We weren't hazed for it, at least I was not, and the sergeants and corporals were amazingly easy to deal with, after the calculated frightfulness of instructors. It took a little while to discover that this comparatively gentle treatment simply meant that we were nobody, hardly worth chewing out, until we had proved in a drop, a real drop, that we might possibly replace real wildcats who had fought and bought it, and whose bunks we now occupied. Let me tell you how green I was. While the Valley Forge was still at Luna Base, I happened to come across my section leader just as he was about to hit dirt, all slicked up in dress uniform. He was wearing in his left earlobe a rather small earring, a tiny gold skull, beautifully made, and under it, instead of the conventional crossed bones of the ancient Jolly Roger design, was a whole bundle of little gold bones, almost too small to see. Back home, I had always worn earrings and other jewelry when I went out on a date. I had some beautiful ear clips, rubies as big as the end of my little finger, which had belonged to my mother's grandfather. I liked jewelry, and had rather resented being required to leave it all behind when I went to basic. But here was a type of jewelry which was apparently okay to wear with uniform. My ears weren't pierced. My mother didn't approve of it for boys. But I could have the jeweler mounted on a clip, and I still had some money left from pay call at graduation, and was anxious to spend it before it mildewed. Sergeant, where do you get earrings like that one? Pretty neat. He didn't look scornful. He didn't even smile. He just said, "You like it?" "I certainly do." The plain, raw gold pointed up the gold braid and piping of the uniform, even better than Jem's would have done. I was thinking that a pair would be still handsomer, with just crossbones instead of all that confusion at the bottom. Does the base PX carry them? No, the PX here never sells them, he added. At least I don't think you'll ever be able to buy one here, I hope. But I'll tell you what, when we reach a place where you can buy one of your own, I'll see to it you know about it. That's a promise. Thanks. Don't mention it. I saw several of the tiny skulls thereafter, some with more bones, some with fewer. My guess had been correct. This was jewelry permitted with uniform, when on pass at least. Then I got my chance to buy one almost immediately thereafter, and discovered that the prices were unreasonably high for such plain ornaments. It was Operation Bughouse, the first battle of Clendethu in the history books, soon after Buenos Aires was smeared. It took the loss of B.A. to make the groundhogs realize that anything was going on, because people who haven't been out don't really believe in other planets, not down deep where it counts. I know I hadn't, and I'd been space-happy since I was a pup. But B.A. really stirred up the civilians and inspired loud screams to bring all our forces home from everywhere, orbit them around the planet practically shoulder to shoulder, and interdict the space Terra occupies. This is silly, of course. You don't win a war by defense, but by attack. No Department of Defense ever won a war. See the histories. But it seems to be a standard civilian reaction to scream for defensive tactics as soon as they do notice a war. Then they want to run the war, like a passenger trying to grab the controls away from the pilot in an emergency. However, nobody asked my opinion at the time, I was told. Quite aside from the impossibility of dragging the troops home, in view of our treaty obligations and what it would do to the colony planets in the Federation and to our allies, we were awfully busy doing something else. To wit, carrying the war to the bugs. I suppose I noticed the destruction of BA much less than most civilians did. We were already a couple of parsecs away under Cherenkov Drive, and the news didn't reach us until we got it from another ship after we came out of Drive. I remember thinking, gosh, that's terrible, and feeling sorry for the one Porteño in the ship. But BA wasn't my home, and Terra was a long way off, and I was very busy, as the attack on Clendethu, the bug's home planet, was mounted immediately after that, and we spent the time in rendezvous strapped in our bunks, doped and unconscious, with the internal gravity field of the Valley Forge off to save power and give greater speed. The loss of Buenos Aires did mean a great deal to me. It changed my life enormously, but this I did not know until many months later. When it came time to drop onto Clendethu, I was assigned to PFC Dutch Bamberger as a supernumerary. He managed to conceal his pleasure at the news, and as soon as the platoon sergeant was out of earshot, he said, "Listen, Boot, you stick close behind me and stay out of my way. You go slowing me down, I'll break your silly neck." I just nodded. I was beginning to realize that this was not a practice drop. Then I had the shakes for a while, and then we were down. Operation Bughouse should have been called Operation Madhouse. Everything went wrong. It had been planned as an all-out move to bring the enemy to their knees, occupy their capital and the key points of their home planet, and end the war. Instead, it darn near lost the war. I am not criticizing General Diens. I don't know whether it's true that he demanded more troops and more support, and allowed himself to be overruled by the Sky Marshal-in-Chief, or not. Nor was it any of my business. Furthermore, I doubt if some of the smart second-guessers know all the facts. What I do know is that the General dropped us and commanded us on the ground, and, when the situation became impossible, he personally led the diversionary attack that allowed quite a few of us, including me, to be retrieved, and in doing so, bought his farm. He's radioactive debris on Clindathu, and it's much too late to court-martial him. So why talk about it? I do have one comment to make to any armchair strategist who has never made a drop. Yes, I agree that the Bugs planet, possibly, could have been plastered with H-bombs until it was surfaced with radioactive glass. But would that have won the war? The Bugs are not like us. The pseudo-arachnids aren't even like spiders. They are anthropods who happen to look like a madman's conception of a giant, intelligent spider. But their organization, psychological and economic, is more like that of ants or termites. They are communal entities, the ultimate dictatorship of the hive. Blasting the surface of their planet would have killed soldiers and workers. It would have not have killed the brain cast and the queens. I doubt if anybody can be certain that even a direct hit with a burrowing H-rocket would have killed a queen. We don't know how far down they are, nor am I anxious to find out. None of the boys who went down those holes came up again. Suppose we did ruin the productive surface of Clindathu. They still would have ships and colonies and other planets, same as we have, and their HQ is still intact. So unless they surrender, the war isn't over. We didn't have Nova bombs at that time. We couldn't crack Clindathu open. If they absorbed the punishment and didn't surrender, the war was still on. If they can surrender. Their soldiers can't. Their workers can't fight. And you can waste a lot of time and ammo shooting up workers who wouldn't say boo. And their soldier caste can't surrender. But don't make the mistake of thinking that the Bugs are just stupid insects because they look the way they do and don't know how to surrender. Their warriors are smart, skilled, and aggressive. Smarter than you are, by the only universal rule, if the Bug shoots first. You can burn off one leg, two legs, three legs, and he just keeps on coming. Burn off four on one side and he topples over, but keeps on shooting. You have to spot the nerve case and get it. Whereupon he will trot right on past you, shooting at nothing until he crashes into a wall or something. The drop was a shambles from the start. 50 ships were in our piece of it, and they were supposed to come out of Cherenkov Drive and into Reaction Drive so perfectly coordinated that they could hit the orbit and drop us, in formation and where we were supposed to hit, without even making one planet circuit to dress up their formation. I suppose this is difficult. Shucks, I know it is. But when it slips, it leaves the MI holding the sack. We were lucky at that, because the Valley Forge and every Navy file in her bought it before we ever hit the ground. In that tight, fast formation, 4 miles per second, orbital speed is not a stroll. She collided with the Ypres, and both ships were destroyed. We were lucky to get out of her tubes, those of us who did get out, for she was still firing capsules as she was rammed. But I wasn't aware of it. I was inside my cocoon, headed for the ground. I suppose our company commander knew that the ship had been lost, and half his wildcats with it, since he was out first and would know when he suddenly lost touch, over the command circuit, with the ship's captain. But there was no way to ask him, because he wasn't retrieved. All I ever had was a gradually dawning realization that things were in a mess. The next 18 hours were nightmare. I shan't tell much about it, because I don't remember much, just snatches, stop-motion scenes of horror. I've never liked spiders, poisonous or otherwise. A common house spider in my bed can give me the creeps. Tarantulas are simply unthinkable, and I can't eat lobster, crab, or anything of that sort. When I got my first sight of a bug, my mind jumped right out of my skull and started to yammer. It was seconds later that I realized that I had killed it and could stop shooting. I suppose it was a worker. I doubt if I was in any shape to tackle a warrior and win. But at that, I was in better shape than was the K-9 Corps. They were to be dropped, if the drop had gone perfectly, on the periphery of our entire target, and the Neo-Dogs were supposed to range outward and provide tactical intelligence to interdiction squads, whose business it was to secure the periphery. Those Calebs weren't armed, of course, other than their teeth. A Neo-Dog is supposed to hear, see, and smell and tell his partner what he finds by radio. All he carries is a radio and a destruction bomb with which he, or his partner, can blow the dog up in case of bad wounds or capture. Those dogs didn't wait to be captured. Apparently, most of them suicided as soon as they made contact. They felt the way I do about the bugs, only worse. They have Neo-Dogs now that are indoctrinated from puppyhood to observe and evade without blowing their tops at the mere sight or smell of a bug. But these weren't. But that wasn't all that went wrong. Just name it. It was fouled up. I didn't know what was going on, of course. I just stuck close behind Dutch, trying to shoot or flame anything that moved, dropping a grenade down a hole wherever I saw one. Presently, I got so that I could kill a bug without wasting ammo or juice, although I did not learn to distinguish between those that were harmless and those that were not. Only about 1 in 50 is a warrior, but he makes up for the other 49. Their personal weapons aren't as heavy as ours, but they are lethal just the same. They've got a beam that will penetrate armor and slice flesh like cutting a hard-boiled egg. And they cooperate even better than we do, because the brain that is doing the heavy thinking for the squad isn't where you can reach it. It's down one of the holes. Dutch and I stayed lucky for quite a long time, milling around over an area about a mile square, corking up holes with bombs, killing what we found above surface, saving our jets as much as possible for emergencies. The idea was to secure the entire target and allow the reinforcements and the heavy stuff to come down without important opposition. This was not a raid. This was a battle to establish a beachhead, stand on it, hold it, and enable fresh troops and heavies to capture or pacify the entire planet. Only we didn't. Our own section was doing all right. It was in the wrong pew and out of touch with the other section. The platoon leader and sergeant were dead and we never reformed. But we had staked out a claim. Our special weapons squad had set up a strong point, and we were ready to turn over our real estate over to fresh troops as soon as they showed up. Only they didn't. They dropped in where we should have dropped, found unfriendly natives, and had their own troubles. We never saw them. So we stayed where we were, soaking up casualties from time to time, and passing them out ourselves as opportunity offered. While we ran low on ammo and jump juice and even power to keep the suits moving. This seemed to go on for a couple of thousand years. Dutch and I were zipping along close to a wall, headed for our special weapons squad in answer to a yell for help, when the ground suddenly opened in front of Dutch. A big bug popped out, and Dutch went down. I flamed the bug and tossed a grenade and the hole closed up, then turned to see what had happened to Dutch. He was down, but he didn't look hurt. A platoon sergeant can monitor the physicals of every man in his platoon, sort out the dead from those who merely can't make it unassisted and must be picked up. But you can do the same thing manually from switches right on the belt of the man's suit. Dutch didn't answer when I called him. His body temperature read 99 degrees. His respiration, heartbeat, and brain wave read 0. Which looked bad, but maybe his suit was dead rather than he himself. Or so I told myself, forgetting that the temperature indicator would give no reading if it were the suit rather than the man. Anyhow, I grabbed the can opener wrench from my own belt and started to take him out of his suit while trying to watch all around me. Then I heard an all-hands call in my helmet that I never want to hear again. Sov Kipu, home, home. Pick up and home. Any beacon you can hear. 6 minutes. All hands, save yourselves. Pick up your mates. Home on any beacon. I hurried. His head came off as I tried to drag him out of his suit, so I dropped him and got out of there. On a later drop, I would have had sense enough to salvage his ammo, but I was far too sluggish to think. I simply bounced away from there, then tried to rendezvous with the strong point we had been heading for. It was already evacuated, and I felt lost. Lost and deserted. Then I heard recall. Not the recall it should have been, Yankee Doodle, if it had been a boat from the Valley Forge, but Sugarbush, a tune I didn't know. No matter, it was a beacon. I headed for it, using the last of my jump juice lavishly. Got aboard just as they were about to button up, and shortly thereafter was in the Vrootrick. In such a state of shock that I couldn't remember my serial number. I've heard it called a strategic victory, but I was there, and I claim we took a terrible licking. 6 weeks later, and feeling about 60 years older, at Fleet Base on Sanctuary, I boarded another ground boat and reported for duty to Ship Sergeant Jalal at the Roger Young. I was wearing, in my pierced left earlobe, a broken skull with one bone. Al Jenkins was with me and was wearing one exactly like it. Kitten never made it out of the tube. The few surviving Wildcats were distributed elsewhere around the fleet. We had lost half our strength, about, in collision with the Valley Forge and the Ypres. That disastrous mess on the ground had run our casualties up over 80%, and the powers that be decided that it was impossible to put the outfit back together with survivors. Close it out, put the records in the archives, and wait until the scars had healed before reactivating Company K, Wildcats, with new faces but old traditions. Besides, there were a lot of empty files to fill in other outfits. Sergeant Jalal welcomed us warmly, told us that we were joining a smart outfit, best in the fleet, in a taut ship, and didn't seem to notice our ear skulls. Later that day, he took us forward to meet the lieutenant, who smiled rather shyly and gave us a fatherly little talk. I noticed that Al Jenkins wasn't wearing his gold skull. Neither was I, because I had already noticed that nobody in Ratchick's Roughnecks wore the skulls. They didn't wear them because, in Ratchick's Roughnecks, it didn't matter in the least how many combat drops you had made, nor which ones. You were either a roughneck, or you weren't. And if you were not, they didn't care who you were. Since we had come to them not as recruits, but as combat veterans, they gave us all possible benefit of doubt, and made us welcome, with no more than that unavoidable trace of formality anybody necessarily shows to a house guest who is not a member of the family. But less than a week later, when we had made one combat drop with them, we were full-fledged roughnecks, members of the family, called by our first names, chewed out on occasion without any feeling on either side that we were less than blood brothers thereby, borrowed from and lent to, included in bull sessions and privileged to express our own silly opinions with complete freedom, and have them slapped down just as freely. We even called non-coms by their first names on any but strictly duty occasions. Sergeant Jalal was always on duty, of course, unless you ran across him dirt side, in which case he was jelly, and went out of his way to behave as if his lordly rank meant nothing between roughnecks. But the lieutenant was always the lieutenant, never Mr. Ratchick, nor even Lieutenant Ratchick, simply the lieutenant, spoken to and of in the third person. There was no god but the lieutenant, and Sergeant Jalal was his prophet. Jelly could say no in his own person, and it might be subject to further argument, at least from junior sergeants. But if he said, the lieutenant wouldn't like it, he was speaking ex cathedra, and the matter was dropped permanently. Nobody ever tried to check up on whether or not the lieutenant would or would not like it. The word had been spoken. The lieutenant was father to us, and loved us, and spoiled us, and was nevertheless rather remote from us aboard ship, and even dirtside, unless we reached dirt via a drop. But in a drop, well, you wouldn't think that an officer could worry about every man of a platoon spread over 100 square miles of terrain. But he can. He can worry himself sick over each one of them. How he could keep track of us all, I can't describe. But in the midst of a ruckus, his voice would sing out over the command circuit, "Johnson, check Squad 6. Smitty's in trouble." And it was better than even money that the lieutenant had noticed it before Smith's squad leader. Besides that, you knew with utter and absolute certainty that, as long as you were still alive, the lieutenant would not get into the retrieval boat without you. There have been prisoners taken in the Bug War, but none from Ratchik's Roughnecks. Jelly was mother to us, and was close to us, and took care of us and didn't spoil us at all. But he didn't report us to the lieutenant. There was never a court-martial among the Roughnecks, and no man was ever flogged. Jelly didn't even pass out extra duty very often. He had other ways of paddling us. He could look you up and down at daily inspection and simply say, "In the Navy, you might look good. Why don't you transfer?" And get results, it being an article of faith among us that the Navy crew members slept in their uniforms and never washed below their collar lines. But Jelly didn't have to maintain discipline among privates, because he maintained discipline among his non-coms, and expected them to do likewise. My squad leader, when I first joined, was Red Green. After a couple of drops, when I knew how good it was to be a roughneck, I got to feeling gay and a bit too big for my clothes, and talked back to Red. He didn't report me to Jelly. He just took me back to the washroom and gave me a medium set of lumps, and we got to be pretty good friends. In fact, he recommended me for Lance later on. Actually, we didn't know whether the crew members slept in their clothes or not. We kept to our part of the ship, and the Navy men kept to theirs, because they were made to feel uncomfortable if they showed up in our country other than on duty. After all, one has social standards one must maintain, mustn't one? The lieutenant had his stateroom in male officers' country, a Navy part of the ship, but we never went there either, except on duty, and rarely. We did go forward for guard duty, because the Roger Young was a mixed ship, female captain and pilot officers, some female Navy ratings. Forward of Bulkhead 30 was ladies' country. And two armed MI, day and night, stood guard at the one door cutting it. At battle stations, that door, like all other gas-tight doors, was secured. Nobody missed a drop. Officers were privileged to go forward of Bulkhead 30 on duty, and all officers, including the lieutenant, ate in a mixed mess just beyond it. But they didn't tarry there. They ate and got out. Maybe other corvette transports were run differently. But that was the way the Roger Young was run. Both the lieutenant and Captain de la Dreyer wanted a taut ship and got it. Nevertheless, guard duty was a privilege. It was a rest to stand beside that door, arms folded, feet spread, doping off and thinking about nothing, but always warmly aware that at any moment you might see a feminine creature, even though you were not privileged to speak to her other than on duty. Once I was called all the way into the skipper's office, and she spoke to me. She looked right at me and said, "Take this to the chief engineer, please." My daily shipside job, aside from cleaning, was servicing electronic equipment under the close supervision of Padre Migliaccio, the section leader of the first section, exactly as I used to work under Carl's eye. Drops didn't happen too often, and everybody worked every day. If a man didn't have any other talent, he could always scrub bulkheads. Nothing was ever quite clean enough to suit Sergeant Jalal. We followed the MI rule. Everybody fights, everybody works. Our first cook was Johnson, the second section's sergeant, a big friendly boy from Georgia. The one in the Western Hemisphere, not the other one. And a very talented chef. He wheedled pretty good, too. He liked to eat between meals himself and saw no reason why other people shouldn't. With the padre leading one section and the cook leading the other, we were well taken care of, body and soul. But suppose one of them bought it. Which one would you pick? A nice point we never tried to settle, but could always discuss. The Roger Young kept busy, and we made a number of drops, all different. Every drop has to be different, so that they can never figure out a pattern on you. But no more pitched battles. We operated alone, patrolling, harrying, and raiding. The truth was that the Terran Federation was not then able to mount a large battle. The foul-up with Operation Bughouse had cost too many ships, way too many trained men. It was necessary to take time to heal up, train more men. In the meantime, small, fast ships, among them the Roger Young and other corvette transports, tried to be everywhere at once, keeping the enemy off balance, hurting him and running. We suffered casualties and filled our holes when we returned to Sanctuary for more capsules. I still got the shakes every drop. But actual drops didn't happen too often, nor were we ever down long. And between times, there were days and days of shipboard life among the roughnecks. It was the happiest period of my life, although I was never quite consciously aware of it. I did my full share of beefing just as everybody else did, and enjoyed that, too. We weren't really hurt until the lieutenant bought it. I guess that was the worst time in all my life. I was already in bad shape for a personal reason. My mother had been in Buenos Aires when the bugs smeared it. I found out about it one time when we put in at Sanctuary for more capsules and some mail caught up with us. A note from my Aunt Eleonora, one that had not been coded and sent fast, because she had failed to mark for that. The letter itself came. It was about 3 bitter lines. Somehow she seemed to blame me for my mother's death. Whether it was my fault because I was in the armed services and should have therefore prevented the raid, or whether she felt that my mother had made a trip to Buenos Aires because I wasn't home where I should have been, was not quite clear. She managed to imply both in the same sentence. I tore it up and tried to walk away from it. I thought that both my parents were dead, since father would never send mother on a trip that long by herself. Aunt Eleonora had not said so, but she wouldn't have mentioned father in any case. Her devotion was entirely to her sister. I was almost correct. Eventually I learned that father had planned to go with her, but something had come up and he stayed over to settle it, intending to come along the next day. But Aunt Eleonora did not tell me this. A couple of hours later, the lieutenant sent for me and asked me very gently if I would like to take leave at Sanctuary while the ship went out on her next patrol. He pointed out that I had plenty of accumulated R&R and might as well use some of it. I don't know how he knew that I had lost a member of my family, but he obviously did. I said no, thank you, sir. I prefer to wait until the outfit all took R&R together. I'm glad I did it that way, because if I hadn't, I wouldn't have been along when the lieutenant bought it, and that would have been just too much to be borne. It happened very fast and just before retrieval. A man in the 3rd squad was wounded, not badly, but he was down. The assistant section leader moved in to pick up and bought a small piece of it himself. The lieutenant, as usual, was watching everything at once. No doubt he had checked physicals on each of them by remote, but we'll never know. What he did was to make sure that the assistant section leader was still alive, then made pickup on both of them himself, one in each arm of his suit. He threw them the last 20 feet, and they were passed into the retrieval boat. And with everybody else in, the shield gone and no interdiction, was hit and died instantly. I haven't mentioned the names of the private and of the assistant section leader on purpose. The lieutenant was making pickup on all of us with his last breath. Maybe I was the private. It doesn't matter who he was. What did matter was that our family had had its head chopped off. The head of the family from which we took our name. The father who made us what we were. After the lieutenant had to leave us, Captain Deladrier invited Sergeant Jalal to eat forward, with the other heads of departments. But he begged to be excused. "Have you ever seen a widow with stern character keep her family together?" By behaving as if the head of the family had simply stepped out and would return at any moment? That's what Jelly did. He was just a touch more strict with us than ever, and if he ever had to say, "The lieutenant wouldn't like that," it was almost more than a man could take. Jelly didn't say it very often. He left our combat team organization almost unchanged. Instead of shifting everybody around, he moved the assistant section leader of the second section over into the nominal platoon sergeant spot, leaving his section leaders where they were needed, with their sections. And he moved me from Lance to assistant squad leader, into acting corporal as a largely ornamental assistant section leader. Then he himself behaved as if the lieutenant were merely out of sight, and that he was just passing on the lieutenant's orders, as usual. It saved us.